Hello, and welcome to Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions, where every episode we discuss some scientific misconceptions, and we hope that you learned something you didn't already know about the world. I am here with my co-host, Margaret. Is that cheese vegan? Put it on my sandwich. Hanslick Burton.
And I'm here with my co-host. Is that deli meat? Hope is vegetarian. Put it on my sandwich. Hanslick Burton.
And joining us as our guest host this episode is...
For the third time
is Brooke. Is that Al wearing glasses? Asky.
Welcome to the show.
Brooke, you did it. You're back on top.
Oh. I did it?
In terms of how many you are leading in terms of
am
how
I?
Many.
You're number three.
Oh. Yeah. Am I
the leaderboard
did
was
I win
at,
something?
You're in the Three Timers Club.
Yep.
Margaret, tell her what the Three Timers Club comes with.
You get pizza, a salad, and a little bit of cream corn.
And a free seltzer water.
A free seltzer. Mm-hmm. Do I have to pay for the food?
No, it's just all included.
Okay, well,
so
that's acceptable.
That's the Three Timers Club.
Mm-hmm. Sick.
Tell the world what it feels like.
It feels like I'm experiencing something unique.
I thought you were going to say for the third time.
For the third, it's exactly the same. No, I tried cream corn for the first time, so I guess that's, you know, a new experience.
Yeah, for our listeners, the things that I listed off are exactly what the three of us had for dinner. So she did get all those things.
Currently eating. Yep.
Yeah.
It's legit. No, it's like legit prizes.
Yeah.
Actually happening.
It did happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our first segment every week is where we share something that we're excited about. Brooke is our special guest. You get to go first. What are you excited about?
Oh, I'm excited about the dumbest thing, which is that I am going to enroll in a freaking 401k, baby.
Hey.
Slash Roth IRA or one of those, either way, for the first time. So I feel real jazzed about it, which is something that I don't think I ever thought I would feel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So thanks. Shout out to Brian, who's an independent financial consultant. If he, for some reason,
Brian,
if he listens to this podcast, thanks, Brian. You the man, because I learned so much. My mind is blown. We're not on that close.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Brian. Mr. Brian.
But he is real cool. Good job, because now I'm going to do it and save money for when I'm old.
Yeah.
So.
Which is very exciting.
Hashtag 2065.
Only a few years to go.
Kimmy, what are you excited about this week?
Well, happy 2020, everybody.
Thank you. First new
podcast episode of the new year.
Thank you.
Hoping you enjoy your 20s. Make sure to
enjoy your 20s, everybody.
Right,
if you're 30, shut up.
Really. Make sure you're writing 2020 on your checks. Mm-hmm. That was a thing. People were really scared about that.
Who is writing checks these days?
Don't write 20. Scammers are going to steal your year, clearly. Did you all see that?
No.
There was like stuff everywhere where they're like, you have to write the full title because if you just write 20 or the full year, if you just write 20, someone will write 1-8 next to it and they'll somehow scam you.
They'll write 1820?
No.
They'll write...
What are you mean?
2018.
Okay.
Oh. Wait, but how is that? So they're just, they just make your check older?
It's just dumb. No.
Is this an email forward you got?
It's been all over like Facebook and Twitter, and it's so dumb. Anyway.
thanks for that warning.
Yeah, thanks for the tip.
What I'm really excited about, though, is that we spent the new year with two lovely dogs, mm-hmm. Billy and Harvey, mm-hmm. who are longtime listeners.
Well.
Never time callers. Spent some time with friends on the Kitsap Peninsula, which is a peninsula in Washington. Woot. And
it's been
a good...
If you're savvy.
The sap.
Is it?
No.
No. Can't.
No
Margaret.
Way. No way.
Anyway, it's been a good start to the year.
Yeah.
Margaret?
So, true to form.
You can't talk about death.
Ooh, that's going to be hard because what I'm excited about are cemeteries.
Is there a new one or something?
Well, no. Well, I'm sure somewhere, but... So over the break, we got to go home and, spent some very quality time with my dad among other family members. Dad is probably listening right now to this podcast as he is on the elliptical at the gym. Well done. Hi, Dad. And my dad and I, toured some cemeteries in Kansas City that I had not been to before because my dad's a historian and he is really good at finding the graves of people that he studied before. So, for example, we saw Charlie Parker's grave. We saw Josephine Yates's grave. And it was just
a really weird flex. Just wanted to throw that out there.
Not to brag, but I do know where Charlie Parker's buried.
It sounds, if you don't know who Charlie Parker is, it sounds like you're hiding secrets from the police.
Yeah, no, he's been passed away for quite a while. I was not involved.
In a marked grave.
Yes, in a very marked grave.
It was a well-publicized event that wasn't scandalous at all.
No. Anyway, so I just really love cemeteries. I try to visit one when I go to new places because I just find them to be such wonderful places to be both outdoors and reflective because you walk around and you look at headstones and you think like, okay, well, this person was, you know, this old when they passed away. I wonder what their life was like. You know, I do.
I thought you were going to say, I wonder how old I'll be.
No. But yeah, you just wonder about people, you know, it's just full of stories and, you know, everybody's got one and you can just kind of walk around and think about things and reflect outdoors. So that's a big plug for cemeteries.
Also, they're spooky.
Also, they're a little spooky, which
sometimes,
I love.
Sometimes, love spooky. Yeah. That's great.
Are we sure you're not being pegged by Big Cemetery to say that?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I'm really
not. Big Cemetery's got you nailed down.
Yep. So that's what I'm excited about.
That wasn't meant to be a pun, but it was a good pun.
It was a good pun.
All right. So let's head into the main segment of the show, the scientific misconceptions. Every week, we'll bring a new scientific misconception to share, explain, and discuss. As a note, each co-host researches their own misconception on their own and brings it to the podcast. The other co-hosts have not heard it at all. This is to make this feel more like a conversation, a discussion where you don't feel like you need to have prepared anything and you can learn alongside with us. We got to do something to find out who goes first.
That's right. So there's three of us, so it's going to be a little bit more difficult this week. What should we do to see who goes first?
Last time we broke the mic stand thingy. But oh, yeah. I see you no longer have the breakable kind.
Oh, yeah, right. We wishboned like the mic stand.
Yeah. Let's do it. Do we want to do a classic three-way rock, paper, scissors? Is it becoming too...
I don't know.
Uniform? Don't know.
Is that something we're going to do forever? Do we want to mix it up?
All right.
Listeners...
Who can do a backflip first?
Yeah.
Oh, then no one. Can you?
Shoot. Okay. No.
Oh, how about you hand me that little piece of art over there that I made? It says Soy Feminista, which means I'm a feminist in Spanish. Part of it is painted. The other side is not. So let's do first Camden against Brooke. I'm going to flip it.
Okay? What do we do? Wait.
You say, well, it's going to go up in the air and you say.
Okay, I want the side that says Soy Feminista, okay. Obviously.
All right. So ready?
So now I have to be the one who doesn't want the feminist?
Yeah. All you right. have to be the one that's not ready? The feminist.
Go for it.
Camden won that one.
As usual.
Here we go. The conspiracy continues.
Right. And now it's me against Camden.
Call it, Margaret.
I'm going to call it in the air. Feminist side. Hey, it was me.
I think it's weighted.
No, I think it goes, so it goes me, Camden, Brooke.
Here we go.
All right. I'm going to pull up my notes here. So I don't know why I was thinking about this misconception, but it's one that a lot of folks have, and it has a really interesting origin. So it's about elephants. What are they afraid of?
Mice.
Peanuts.
Oh.
Cheese.
Are they afraid of peanuts?
No, you throw them.
Peanuts are afraid of
zoos
elephants.
Are very different nowadays.
Yes, they are. Truly.
Mice.
Yes, yes. Elephants are thought to be afraid of mice. So let's talk about, well, first let me thank my sources, BBC Earth.
Thank you.
Snopes.
Thank you, Canadians.
And Live Science.
Thanks.
So the origins of the myth are our good old friend and a friend of the podcast Sawbones,
P.T. Barnum.
Pliny the Elder. He wrote that elephants, quote, detest a mouse more than any other animal. In Dumbo, Timothy Q. Mouse scares elephants. I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
That movie is...
Did you watch?
It's pretty scary.
Did any of you see the remake?
No.
Sounds. Oh, it looks terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Unless they want to sponsor you.
Sure. In which case,
Disney.
Disney.
Hey there, Disney.
Disney wants to sponsor.
Are either of you afraid of mice?
No. No. I think they're cute.
What's the context? I had three gerbils growing up, and they're pretty much a mouse.
Camden, that's a different animal.
Different animal, Camden.
Say more.
Misconception. We'll cover that misconception later. The gerbils and mice are the same.
I thought it was just German for mouse.
Nope. No.
Is it actually German?
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my gosh. So the word for being scared of mice is murophobia. M-U-R-O, phobia. There are stories of mice biting the feet of elephants or of crawling up inside their trunks, which is a...
Here's an idea.
Bad thing.
Never say that again.
Okay, great. So there's no evidence to back that up. There's an ancient Greek fable about a mouse that crawled up an elephant's trunk. Although I found that according to Francisco Rodriguez Adaros in his book History of the Greco-Latin Fable, this myth is not Greek in origin. So a lot of thoughts about that. Went down a rabbit hole.
Okay.
There is a fable, but what no one agrees statement. How it started. Yeah. I found a fable, though, from the Northeast Congo in which a mouse, in an effort to drive an elephant away from its nest, crawled up inside its trunk and, like, scratched and, like, bit. And eventually the elephant lost his or her mind and died. And then the mouse's nest was safe.
So I don't know what we're supposed to learn. Follow-up question.
Sure. Go ahead.
If you make an elephant go insane inside the elephant, what happens to you?
I think it just crawled out again. Yeah.
I'm skeptical.
Not as epic of a story as you were expecting.
I had heard this other fable about a lion and a mouse and an elephant before.
Yeah, I've heard the lion and the mouse thing, but
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, that's like they become friends or something, right? That's like with the thorn in the paw and the mouse.
Oh, that's a different one.
Is that a different one?
Yeah. I was thinking of the one where, like, somehow a lion is, like, in the bushes, and there's a mouse and an elephant, and the elephant accidentally steps on the mouse's tail, and in that same moment, the lion roars for some reason, but the elephant can't see the lion, so thinks that the mouse roared, and the elephant says, like, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize you were so powerful, I will never do that again. So, again, not sure what that lesson is.
Sometimes a story is just a story.
Sometimes a story is just a story.
I was going to say, there's a lot of stories going on.
Yeah. See, there's a lot of... It's an interesting origin story about how mice and elephants are related. There was also the idea that because there was thought to be no barrier between the trunk of the elephant and the elephant's windpipe, that elephants were, quote, worried that a mouse would crawl up their trunk and make it impossible to breathe.
Mm.
I guess I never thought about why elephants would be afraid of mice.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought through the, like, they could fit a mouse inside.
Sure. But there is a barrier, the epiglottis.
It's not just a giant tube.
It's not just one tube. So they don't really need to be worried about that. Mm. Even if, I was reading that even if that situation occurred, the elephant could just blow out and the mouse would be out of their trunk.
Right.
So.
Right.
All right, so
unless
this is
a real dumb elephant.
Sure,
it got real Dumbo.
All right, Disney's never going to sponsor us now.
You know what? Wow. We don't need their money.
Well,
oh, are we? Do we need their money?
Okay. All right, so here's why it's not true. It's true. Mice are not something that elephants fear. So elephants don't fear much, which makes them great at dealing with large predators that they have in their habitat, like lions and tigers.
And bears.
Maybe. Oh. They might not be scared of bears. But elephants don't like to be surprised. So it's not really about mice. It's about the fact that elephants don't like to be startled.
Because their love language is not gifts.
That's so
Are gifts startling?
Sometimes. Like right I now, if I was like, here you go.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, they wouldn't like that. They wouldn't like that. Josh Plotnick, a researcher of elephant behavior and intelligence at the University of Cambridge in England, says that anything that moves quickly near an elephant can scare it. Doesn't matter what it is. Okay. Elephants get nervous when sounds or movements happen that they don't recognize.
Me too.
Yeah, who doesn't? Exactly, who doesn't?
Brooke is easily spooked.
It could happen with any animal, cats, small dogs, anything.
Brooks.
Elephants also, I learned, don't have really good vision, so it's easy to startle them. They're also very, their eyes are way high up.
Right.
Citation.
So they couldn't, they really couldn't even see something small on the ground like a mouse.
Oh.
A mouse would be unlikely to catch their attention.
They're like, have short range vision or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not very good. In 2006, ABC's 2020 did an experiment with elephants at the Barnum and Bailey Circus, which I don't believe uses elephants anymore. But when they did have them, trainers held mice in their hands and showed them to elephants. And the elephants did not care at all. They looked bored, was the quote. Didn't care.
Sorry. It's a bored elephant.
Just, you know. Just long size.
I mean, they were in a circus. So they probably looked more than bored.
Yeah.
Sorry. Shout out to not having animals in a circus.
Yeah. Yep. Like I said, I don't think they use them anymore. And again, most animals are scared of surprises. For example, the other day I walked into a store and there was a golden retriever that the store owner had. And I was startled. Even though I love golden retrievers, I was surprised in that moment. So...
And the lesson here is that humans can get startled just like elephants.
Yeah.
And the golden retriever was bored.
The golden retriever was very excited to see me and presented me with a ball.
Opposite of an elephant.
Yeah,
opposite is what you're saying. Of an elephant. Gotcha.
So here's what is true. There is an animal that elephants do appear to be scared of.
Here we go.
Do you know
I know
what
it. Yes.
People. What is it?
Snakes.
Nope.
Oh.
No.
Lions.
Bees.
Oh.
Oh, wait. I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. So they do appear to be scared of at least the sound of bees.
That makes sense.
So recorded sounds of African honeybees were played to resting elephants.
Yeah.
And when the sound started, most of the elephants ran away.
Oh.
They didn't want to stay where that sound was happening. Researchers are now exploring the idea of using bees to keep elephants from eating crops. So if they hear that sound, they stay away. So, for example, there's this really cool project called Elephants and Bees Project. From their website, this project is an innovative study using an in-depth understanding of elephant behavior to reduce damage from crop-raiding elephants using their instinctive avoidance of African bees. The project explores the use of novel beehive fences as a natural elephant deterrent, creating a social and economic boost to poverty-stricken rural communities through pollination services and the sustainable harvesting of elephant-friendly honey. So they basically put hives of these bees along the border of a area with crops in it, and that's supposed to keep the elephants away. And, of course, that beehive fence serves not only for that purpose, but it also provides bees to help pollinate that area.
That's really clever.
Yeah, there's some version of that fence in 15 different countries, and if you want to donate to this project, it's elephantsandbees.com/donate. But it reminded me of when Cam and I spent some time in Borneo.
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah. Elephants were a big problem in palm oil plantations because they would come in, they would destroy things, and then to retaliate, the elephants would be killed in some way, whether through poison or getting shot, which is not great. There's that human-elephant conflict, which is a problem. So the bees might be a really good solution for that area, too.
I was thinking about they use calcium carbide and water, which when put together makes a very loud sound.
Yeah.
And so they just make a giant scary bang.
They're called elephant cannons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though there's nothing shot out of them.
No, just noise.
Wow.
So maybe bees would be a good solution to that. So in conclusion, not scared of mice, are scared of the sound of bees.
Thanks, Margaret.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks for telling us about... No, really. Everything
so
I say sounds sarcastic, but it's usually Sometimes not.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't know about that
project
or that there was such a big conflict with elephants, because I feel like we don't hear about that one as much. So that's good to know.
Yeah. So they're scared of bees.
Go bees.
So Cam, it's your turn. Oh, I love bees.
And elephants. I mean, elephants are cool too. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
We're more likely to see bees around here though.
Yeah.
Camden.
All right. World's best holiday gift I got from Margaret. I got the book Human Errors, a panorama of our glitches from pointless bones to broken genes, authored by Nathan H. Lentz, a professor at John Jay College in New York. It's a great book. There are a million misconceptions in it. It's all about basically why humans aren't perfect. There's so many things actually wrong with them. Often we want to think of ourselves as the like epitome of evolution, when in reality, there are so many things wrong with us.
Yeah, that's, I don't want to step on your toes, but that's a big misconception of evolution is that evolution is like leading us towards being humanity. The perfect.
That there's an end goal.
Yeah, that there's an end goal and there's not.
Yeah. There's many misconceptions down the road, which is like, why aren't all things evolving in humans?
They're not.
Shortest answer, they're not. That's a later episode.
It would not work.
Yeah. But there's so many things in it. I love this book, Human Errors. I picked the number one thing I want to share from this book is the one that really, a lot of things blew my mind, but this one I had never thought of before. Mm-hmm. So here's my question. And this is also where a lot of my information comes from, is this book.
Sure.
What was the average lifespan of human beings 100 years ago?
Oh, 100 years ago?
This is worldwide. Just take a guess.
I think it's supposed to have been shorter.
Right.
What do you think the average lifespan was?
100 years ago, I think the average lifespan was 65.
Yeah, I was going to say like 60.
Okay. How about 1,000 years ago?
I would imagine like
it couldn't have gone much lower, right? Because then you just wouldn't have humans.
Yeah.
Well, remember humans reproduce around like, you know,
12 or something.
They can start reproducing at 12. Up through.
So like
30s.
maybe like 35.
Okay. What about 10,000 years ago?
Two.
Yeah. The average. A year and then we're out.
No, so that's not a misconception. All right. So clearly, whenever any of us on the show ask a question at the beginning, it's always a trap because why else would I be talking about it? How long this question of what the human lifespan, it used to be so much shorter, right? It turns out not so much.
What?
Bum, bum, bum. All right. How long did ancient humans live? Let's start with that. I got a lot of information from this book. Also, the book Expectations of Life, a study in the demography, statistics, history, and war, and history of world mortality, and written in 1990, crazy title, and a 2005 Brown University paper, as well as the World Bank for some of these statistics about human lifespans. Mm-hmm. It's not true that we actually didn't live that long back in the day.
What day?
The prehistory.
Oh, okay.
I can work backwards. As of the 2017 World Bank statistic is that the human lifespan around the world is 72 years old.
Okay.
In 1950, the world lifespan was 48.
What?
In 1900, the average lifespan was 31. Now, of course, this is world, right? So it's heavily influenced by some places where the lifespan is pretty long.
Yeah.
Some places where it's not. For example, in England, already in the 1500s, England, since they have one of the longest like recorded histories of like a census, so it's like their data is a little more
robust.
Mm-hmm. In the 1500s, the average lifespan was 71 years old.
Wow.
Whoa.
The 1400s, it was 69 years old.
Hey.
The 1300s, it was 45 years old.
That really goes back a long
time. In the 1200s, it was 64 years old. What happened in the 1300s?
The Black Plague.
The Black Plague. Oh. Very good. During trying not to be completely Eurocentric, the Islamic Golden Age, which lasted from 700 to 1300 AD, the average lifespan was 35 years old.
Wow.
Mm. Ancient Greece was 27 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Bronze Age, which was 3200 BC, was 26 years old.
That's crazy.
Oldest, like, that we can even sort of estimate, the Paleolithic era of over 3 million years ago was 33 years old. So wow. You might be saying, Camden, 33 years old is like way under 72 of 2017.
Camden, 33 years old is way under go ahead.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what I'm saying.
But this misconception comes at taking lifespan is actually like very, a little flawed in its design. So I'll give you this idea. If you walk into a bar, let's say the three of us walk into a bar.
What's the punchline?
Yeah.
Our average salary is just going to be, our total salary is divided by three. I think
that's typically how averages work, yeah.
Great. If Bill Gates walks into this bar now, and mm-hmm. there's four of us in it, mm-hmm. and this could happen, we're in Seattle.
He better buy us all a drink.
He's going to buy us a drink. What is our average salary now?
Way more than I can think.
Probably millions.
Yeah.
Is that really a great statistic to throw out if someone walks in and is like, hey, what's the average salary in this room?
Right.
They're like, million. We're all millionaires.
None of your business.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bill Gates is an outlier.
So there are outliers that cause these lifespans to be reported and is what gets stuck in our head as how long humans lived.
Mm-hmm.
What might be the reasons, or why might this be the case that those lifespans were so short, even though we know they're averages?
Does it include infant mortality?
Yes.
See, that's interesting because Burke and I both work at the aquarium. Anonymity. And we often have a hard time answering exactly what like a harbor seal's average lifespan is because sometimes statistics take pup mortality into account and some don't because pup mortality is like 50%.
Right. So if you take that into account, the lifespan's really short.
Really low. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting.
And essentially that is what's going on here. I told you all these numbers, but I can also tell you these numbers again after people were age 20, if they survived to 15 or 20 years old.
Mm.
Paleolithic era, 3 million years ago, the average lifespan after that 15 years old was 54 years.
Dang.
Okay.
Then Bronze Age, 12,000 years ago, was 60 years old. The Ancient Greece, which I said was 27 years old. Lifespan after 15, 64 to 68 years old.
Holy
wow. Ancient Rome.
Really high infant mortality rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Islamic Golden Age, which I said was 700 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
After 20 years old, they could live 60 to 80 years.
Wow.
So just as I'm sure as you all know working in an aquarium, once you make it past that scary baby adolescent time,
mm-hmm.
your lifespan is like pretty like, you have pretty good chances of living out a full life, considering you don't, like, fall off a cliff.
Sure.
Or whatever the equivalent of an otter's version of that is. Or the Black Plague.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you don't fall off a cliff.
The Black Plague of otters.
No.
How cute.
So really this idea of, like, as long as they live past 20.
Yeah.
They live
pretty much okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that humans, we have this like it's not a total misconception, but this idea that like modern medicine allowed us to go from like living 30 years to now we live like 70, 80 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What Nathan H. Lentz argues in his book, which makes a lot of sense, is like really modern medicine just kept babies alive.
Yeah.
Which is important. That's not to take away from that, but it's not so much. Really, we've added like a decade to that. Like you saw those numbers were 60s.
Right.
And right now that average lifespan is 72.
Which
so
really just seems like naturally part of our human evolution. Yep.
But it's not this significant, like we've doubled our lifespan. I mean, we have, but not in the way people think.
Right.
It wasn't like people were just croaking at 38 because their bodies couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
It was on average. We just divided
many more people
all of those
died
numbers.
As infants. Right.
Yep. So I was like, it seemed like such a simple idea, as mm-hmm. I'm sure like you all think of in the aquarium, but it is one that like, I think a lot of people think humans have just always died really like 30-ish years old and they're done.
But
our bodies have, and something else he talks about in this book a lot is like, our bodies really haven't evolved since we like developed, like really in the Neolithic, like Stone Age area, like that's kind of what our bodies were evolved for, and they haven't changed since.
Right.
So a lot of this book, which is fascinating, is all about all these things that are like broken in us are more like, well, it made sense thousands, almost millions of years ago, but it doesn't really make sense anymore.
This might be taking us in a totally different direction, but aren't there things that have changed about us in recent history? Like, we were just talking about people used to be shorter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like some of those things are true, but some of that is like a genetic, like we are evolving. I'm not saying that humans aren't evolving still. Yeah. That would be incorrect, which is a great point to not, I don't want to create a misconception.
Thank you.
Humans are still evolving. I think it's also this idea of like, height is also something that comes with general health, which is improving. And it's also a piece of sexual selection. Like mates are preferred for having like certain characteristics like height.
Yeah. I also saw a study or an article or something once that said people are getting more attractive overall, which is just the result of sexual selection. Yeah. But it's just an interesting thing. Like overall, you can be pickier. There's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So people are choosing people they're more attracted to.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good point. I think my point being, it just, that isn't so much affecting lifespan. But yeah. You are right. We're still evolving. There's just lots of ways.
Lifespan.
Because we don't really have a reason to live longer. Mm-hmm. I mean.
And one other thing that he talks about is like, which is a great point, what will eventually get humans to live longer? The biggest reason we're dying anymore is we actually are like reach. Before people thought we were like, you know, just at 38, just like, oh, our bodies can't take it, so which tired. Wasn't true. However, our bodies are kind of at that point now. Mm-hmm. Generally the number, like if dying of old age is generally the result of your chromosomes lose pieces at the ends of them.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
There's a lot of information out there about telomeres, which are the very end. Aging is essentially you're losing bits of your chromosomes, and eventually you start losing really important bits, and that can lead to some crazy cancers, which usually is like a lot of why people end up going out if they live long enough. Mm-hmm. And so, although he makes an interesting point, like we might be getting to the place where instead of solving some of those crazy diseases that just show up over time, we might have better luck just transplanting people into torsos with like younger torsos.
Wait, really?
Like keep your brain.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait.
Like keeping your brain.
What does that mean? Transferring torsos.
Like.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more.
Well,
about
people.
That.
So people say head transplants, but that's not totally accurate because it's really you're getting a new body.
Right. But just the brain is transplanted.
No, it'd be like you. I don't look. I'm not a doctor, but it's basically it's like the idea if you want it to still quote be you.
Right.
You need your brain.
So your brain. Yeah.
So it'd be like putting your head on like a younger torso.
Oh, everybody,
don't like that.
Hey world, let's not do that.
Let's stop that.
Well,
let's
he makes a point. Please. He's like, this is a thought experiment. Clearly, there's a lot of considerations on where do we get these torsos from.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of sci-fi movies have covered that. Yeah.
But it's interesting in that, like, more so the point being, like, we might actually get better. We might figure out a way to do that before we figure out a way to get
stop
rid of all
aging.
This.
From stop from falling apart.
Yep. So that's like, will we ever really get to a point where we can't age anymore? The last thing I wanted to share is what else can we do to raise the lifespan? There's actually an easier one, and it's the reason our lifespan has gone up already, which is protecting infants and mothers. Three biggest things that we could ever do to increase the lifespan around the world.
I bet I know what one is.
Go for it.
Vaccines.
Well, actually, vaccines, yes.
Nope. Sorry.
Dang it. I thought I was so confident.
Look, I'm not going to say no to that answer.
You had that, like, your face top, told me it was vaccines.
Well, the top three, at least that were quoted in several sources, are, which make a lot of sense, are, like, family planning, investing in contraceptives, education.
Yep. I knew that. I should have.
And the third one
so embarrassed.
Is empowering women.
I was, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, which I'm not going to say vaccines aren't right. But.
Really great way to stop the world from burning down.
Yeah.
So true.
Actually is giving women access to contraceptives and education.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically accurate. So.
Yes.
Overall.
100%.
Camden. Yeah, Camden. Yeah,
so sorry.
Oh my gosh.
Well, to continue with that, like two big things are people dying in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
In Somalia, for example, they have the highest mothers, death rate or
maternal
death rate during childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
1% of all births in Somalia end up with the mother dying, compared to 0.024% of the United States, which is awful. And even the United States, though, actually 0.024 sounds not like a lot.
Right.
That is triple what it was in 1984.
Yeah, it should be way lower.
There's a lot of growing research right now that the, as I'm sure you all know, the number of C-sections that are occurring in the United States mm-hmm. is due to a lot of legal concerns of doctors has led to this. And in infant mortality, Afghanistan has an 11.5% rate of infant mortality. 11.5% of all births in Afghanistan, and 10.5% of all births in Mali, which were the two highest of those babies are dying in childbirth. The United States, just for comparison, is 0.58%. Mm-hmm. Again, doesn't sound like a lot in comparison. Still pretty high for a developed country. What you could do to both, besides just education, and if you want to support in other ways to invest in contraceptions, family planning, and women empowerment, you can also give to UNICEF, which works in all three of the countries I mentioned. Donate.unicef.org.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a lot of work in Mali, Afghanistan, and Somalia, specifically around their efforts in helping women in childbirth during the entire process of pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's increase the human lifespan again.
If I can add one quick note. I just looked up here. The United States, the state with the highest maternal mortality rate, it's kind of a tie between Georgia, Louisiana, and Indiana. And for black women, it's even higher in those states.
Mm-hmm.
So lots to do in the United States as well as other countries.
And the UNICEF, and UNICEF does work in the United States as well.
Cool.
So if you're supporting them, you're supporting everybody.
That's great.
Thanks, Camden.
Yeah.
I did not realize what a impact that infant mortality would have on the ideas that I had about how long people live.
Yeah. I feel like that was a really profound one, taking us back.
Thanks.
Through the ages.
Literally.
Literally. In many ways.
All right, Brooke.
All right.
Bring us home.
Great follow-up. Mine is not as profound, but it is. It's about migration. Everybody.
Hey.
Because what happens? I gave you the answer already. I should have asked a question like Camden does, like a good teacher. So what do animals do in the winter in order to stay warm? There are a couple of answers.
Sleep.
One of them is hibernation, which you've already covered, so I'm not covering it.
And then also,
period.
I thought you were talking in the class, but you meant the podcast.
Then they migrate to warmer places.
Yeah.
They migrate to warmer places. Also a thing that happens. So does migration only happen in the winter, everyone?
Yes.
Yes. I bet is what I'm supposed to say.
Yeah. You can say what you think.
Well, I kind of did think that.
That's what this, I would say, this podcast say the things you think weren't.
But there's also, like, they could migrate to breeding grounds or to, like, food.
Yep.
Like, I was talking to some folks about penguins today, and penguins migrate for both breeding and food.
Absolutely.
Not to warmer places.
Absolutely. So, yeah. couple of misconceptions that are construed in the idea of migration. I taught this concept to kindergartners today. So
nice.
I assume y'all can also get in on this.
I'd suggest keeping the same lesson plan.
I'm going to give you some harder concepts to deal with. So get ready, everybody. Okay. Right. Buckle down. Migration. Does anybody know what that means? Can somebody tell me? Raise your hand if you think you know what migration is. Yeah.
Is it like moving in and out of a population?
So it could involve that as well. But the broader definition is not within a population so much as within a geographic area.
Got it.
So migration is just really basic. An animal usually seasonally moving from one area to another.
Okay.
And usually back again. Maybe not, but eventually back again. Maybe not immediately.
Okay.
So when I went to school, I learned about migration, primarily about birds for some reason.
Yeah.
And I feel like we all learned.
Popular one.
Right? Yeah. I feel like when you say migration, you always think like birds.
Go south.
And the
birds
winter.
Birds go south for the winter.
So there's other animals that also migrate, though.
Okay.
And you mentioned a couple of the reasons. So reasons can be food. Mm-hmm. It can be for breeding grounds, like you said. It can also be to find more space. Like maybe you migrate and you just immigrate in a way and you don't come back because you need more space, right?
Yeah.
That's a normal thing. So other animals do that too. You said penguins, other birds as well. Obviously, that's not a misconception. Mm-hmm. Herding mammals, so like elk will move around during the winter to find new places to eat that good grass. Butterflies, like you mentioned, there's a big, huge monarch butterfly migration every winter across North America. Pretty big deal. Whales, so things in the ocean migrate. Even salmon will migrate every year. Big deal around here. But why would an animal need to migrate? Because we talked about the resources that they need, but why do animals need to migrate specifically in the winter? Why do you think? We listed a lot of animals here, but
there's possibly food scarcity, right?
Yeah, so when
things aren't growing as much in the winter.
Things get cold, things don't grow.
Mm-hmm.
And also, warm, maybe they aren't adapted to live in colder environments.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Is there more? I feel like there's more.
There's more to do with it.
Okay.
So, no, you did. That's it.
Okay. Okay.
Unwinding from a stressful year.
Yeah. Just taking a holiday. I don't know. Animals have a lot of adaptations to help them survive in the winter. Animals have fur. Animals have feathers. Animals hibernate or go through torpor, which is another thing you mentioned before. Animals can find a shelter to keep them warm or safe. Or dry, or whatever it is.
Check out episode 4?
I don't remember.
Find
Laura Howard's episode about poop plugs and torpor.
Yeah, bears. Bears go through torpor.
Yeah.
Don't hibernate. Mm-mm. That's what I learned. From you.
Yay.
Episode 3.
So, why do they migrate in the winter? Well, not all animals do. There are lots of animals that do not migrate in the wintertime. So there are animals that stay in the same spot because their fur is thick enough, their feathers are thick enough. So a lot of people think birds. All birds go south for the winter. Well, there's still birds here, as you might notice. There are a number of different types of birds who stay here all winter long. But some birds do migrate. So the biggest misconception that I wanted to mention is that birds don't migrate for warmth. They migrate for food, which you might already know if you know a lot about, like, birds. But it's like a big misconception that I think we're all taught in school for some reason. We never learn why they're migrating, actually, and we just, like, I think assume that it's because it's cold.
Yeah.
But actually, birds are pretty well adapted to survive the cold because they have down feathers And there are a lot of birds who like molt in the summer or fall, and then they regrow all their feathers and they grow a thicker layer of down for the winter. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so there's a lot of birds who have an adaptation to survive the cold just like any other animal does. So it's not because they're too cold and they can't handle it. It's because they run out of the food that they need. So there's, for example, Franklin's gulls, which are a type of seagull or just gull, who you can find on the beaches here in Washington, and they eat little crustaceans. Well, in the wintertime, there's not a whole lot of little baby crustaceans out because they don't breed until the spring. Mm-hmm. So they travel south, where it's a little warmer, where things are still reproducing, and they find little crustaceans down there, and then they come back up to where there's food again.
Nice.
Songbirds and other, like, you know, I don't know a lot about birds. Not a bird expert. Songbirds, little birds that eat, like, seeds, fruits, stuff like that that grows on plants. Obviously, not a lot of that.
Not a lot of that.
Some of that.
Unless you're living outside of our apartment. Shout out to those juncos out there. They got enough seeds.
Shout out to the juncos. Juncos do stay here. Yeah. Yeah, as is evidenced. Also, a big one. Hummingbirds.
Those are small ones.
So,
well done.
Sorry to correct you on that.
Scientifically smaller. Hummingbirds. Some hummingbirds migrate because they can't find the flowers that they need to get nectar from, which is what they eat. So they migrate south as well, where there are still flowers blooming. Right? So it's not about them being cold. It's about the fact that when it gets cold up here or in the northern hemisphere, they can't find the food that they're used to having, and so they have to migrate. Now, this is a big energy expenditure, right? It's a big deal to have to migrate that far, like multiple states down, if we're thinking about it. Like,
or countries sometimes.
Or countries, if we're thinking, there's a hummingbird who lives in Washington, who now I forget the name of, because I'm going to talk about Rufus. A different one. It's not the Annas, it's the Rufus. They migrate all the way from Washington to Mexico every year.
That's
huge. They make a pit stop in California, but that's a really big trip. So you have to think about it, like, for an animal to go through that every year, it has to be, like, a major payoff. So if they could find the food that they needed here, they would just stay here.
Yeah.
Like, there would not be a reason to leave. So it's only because they really would starve if they stayed here. So it's not just because they get a little chilly. They're cooler than that.
Yeah.
So that's, like, the biggest thing. I feel like I kind of missed that information in school.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people did, and they still go through life not really knowing why birds are migrating. So I thought that was interesting. But also, there's a bird that doesn't migrate that I wanted to point out, which is the other hummingbird that you mentioned, Anna's hummingbird, does not migrate during the wintertime. They stay here. So the Rufus hummingbirds, they migrate all the way down to Mexico. Anna's hummingbird, for whatever reason, I guess it can find enough food or historically has been able to find enough food. They don't need to migrate.
That's interesting because they eat the same things.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, they have not adapted to go through migration. They don't instinctually know to do that. It's all, by the way, instinctual. So it's not like a bird will just individually decide, oh, I need to travel. It's like very instinctual.
I have that itch. I gotta go.
Right.
Wanderlust.
That always impresses me about evolution, that like evolving, like, that instincts get inherited.
Yeah.
That, like, that's fascinating to me. Kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, and it has to be. And I'll tell you about a cool study in a second about that. But the Anna's hummingbird does not migrate. And so a lot of people don't realize that because we tend to have, for some reason, even though we see, like, corvids, like crows or ravens, we see birds of prey, like vultures, scavengers, eagles, owls. We see all of those birds around during the winter. We know that they don't leave, chickadees, juncos, just to name a few. But still, for some reason, even like for me, it's always like this thought like, oh, there's the birds are gone. Like we don't, they're not even here anymore. Even though I see them all the time. Like it's just this thought of like winter means nothing's out there, right? Misconception. So, if you feed hummingbirds, which is a nice thing to do, couple things to point out about that. But if you feed hummingbirds, that's a nice thing to do. You should keep doing it in the winter. Because Anna's hummingbirds don't leave. And they're going to keep coming back to your feeder because they remember where it is. Hoping that there will be some nice sugar water.
I saw one fly by the other day and we didn't have anything in it.
Oh, we got to. Okay, this is a good reminder to refill our hummingbird feeder. Thank you.
Reminder for everybody, fill it up because there's still hummingbirds around who are going to be looking for that food. And even though usually we don't, like in general, you don't advocate for like feeding wildlife. Mm-hmm. Pollinators are having a real hard time right now,
as
many people probably know, because of the state of the world. Bees are dying off. There's not enough pollinators pollinating all the flowers. There's not enough flowers. It's a cyclical thing. Mm-hmm. So hummingbirds are also affected by that because they're a pollinator as well, and they have to drink nectar from the flowers just like bees do. So that's an animal that you should feel happy to feed and, like, ethical and environmentally savvy about feeding is hummingbirds. So definitely if you have a hummingbird feeder, if you want to make one, just like, you know, it gets frosty out there. So just try to defrost it every once in a while. Like make sure there's some stuff in there for your hummingbirds because they will remember it all winter. And if they make the journey all the way to your house where they expect to find it, that's an energy expenditure for them. Yeah. And if they don't find it,
they've got to go somewhere else.
They've got to go somewhere else, and they might not find it somewhere else. Yeah. So just something to keep in mind that Anna's hummingbirds are still here. Keep feeding them. They're relying on it to get through the winter. So good thing to keep in mind. Now, the study I was going to mention, I don't have the citation written down, but there's a study I learned about in an animal behavior class, and they actually – so we usually have a hard time figuring out, like, how animals know where to go when they're migrating. So, like, people have, for example, like, salmon, we know that they can smell their hormones all the way back to where they started their life, which is pretty crazy.
It's crazy.
But there's, like, whale migrations where we don't completely know how they know where to go every year.
Shark migrations, we don't know.
Shark migrations. We have some predictions, like we think that they can sense like the electromagnetism of the Earth, of the planet, which is crazy and bonkers. They might use sights or senses or smells. They might use senses to get places, but they actually tested, it was songbirds, and I don't remember what exact type of bird, but they basically found out that birds use the stars to navigate. Wow. And so they, from the time they are born or hatched and sitting in their nest, are looking up at the sky to the arrangement of the stars, and that tells them what direction they should be going in. And they tend to pinpoint a certain star and follow it. So kind of interesting.
Very interesting,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. So that's...
Look at those.
That's that.
Look at those birds. It's very poetic, too. I don't know. Yeah. I like the idea of birds looking up at the stars.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah.
Yeah, so kind of cool. But all, again, all instinctual. It's not like a individual bird is like...
Choice.
I'm going to leave now because it's cold. It's like an instinctual thing because over generations, they know there's not enough food here in the winter. Yeah. Wow. That's migration.
Thanks, Brooke.
Yeah.
Well done. And refill your hummingbirds, everyone. Looking at you, Camden, and looking at me. Refill your hummingbirds.
Feeders.
Did I say refill your hummingbirds?
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, you're doing both.
Oh, also, yeah, refill their little bellies.
Refill their little bellies.
Speaking of bellies, before ending each episode, we thought we would have a short segment sharing something interesting we've read, listened, watched, or otherwise consumed.
Okay, there's the tie-in. There's the
bellies
tie-in.
This week.
That was a big
I think it was good. Bellies. You consume stuff. It goes in your belly. Here we go. Let's go in reverse.
Yeah.
Brooke.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
What have you been consuming?
What have I been consuming? I was going to say something. Oh, I've been consuming a lot of cat Instagram pages.
Oh.
Thank God.
I thought you were going to end with cat.
I thought you were going to say food.
No. You know, oh gosh, no, I'm not that crazy yet.
Soon enough.
Cat Instagram pages, because sometimes you just reach an age where you can look at pictures of cute animals and just start crying for an unknown reason.
Have you reached that age?
It seems I have. and it's very cathartic to see a cute animal and just have a little cry.
Mm-hmm.
For who knows why, but just it triggers something.
Yeah.
And it's nice. And also, this is a subtle way to plug my own cat's Instagram.
Yes, yes.
So you don't have to follow me on Instagram, just my cat.
How can we find him?
You can find him at Mogul's the Mogul. So that's Mogul's, M-O-W-G-L-E-S, the T-H-E, Mogul, M-O-G-U-L, at Mogul's the Mogul on Instagram. I finally gave him the Instagram he deserves.
Yeah.
He's 7 years old. He's been waiting. You know what I mean? So it finally paid off. He has one. So hit him up. Slide into his DMs.
Slide into that cat's DMs.
He'll appreciate it.
Nice. Yeah. Moguls.
Moguls the Mogul.
But also just follow cats in general because mm-hmm. they're great. And other animals.
Yeah.
I'm following a snake on Instagram. Oh. Anything you want. They're great.
Thanks, sorts of animals.
Cameron, what have you been consuming besides human errors?
Besides that, I kind of reached, I don't know if you ever get to this, like when you finished, we had just listened to all of the Comedy Bang Bang, like best ofs, and I was just like, I need a new podcast that's different. So what I normally do is I just go to like what's trending on podcasts to see what things I would like. And I realize I am very late to this game, but the number one downloaded podcast, at least what it showed on Apple Podcasts last year, was the podcast 1619,
which is the
podcast that was produced last year, 2019, I don't think celebrating, but marking the 400 years of slavery in America. And so the first slave ships arrived in North America in 1619. The podcast is produced through the New York Times. It is excellent. It talks basically just about how slavery has just infiltrated every walk of American life, from our economy and how loans are used and have, of course, been used, like how they were like developed as a way to, like, slaves used to be used as collateral, and that like this turned into how like loans work because you couldn't have a mortgage on land back in that time because land wasn't worth anything, to episodes about the birth of American music and how all music has its roots in slavery, and how you can't really claim, one great thing is like you can't claim to like love certain types of music but then also say you don't like rap because that's just not how that works. And Margaret, you mentioned, I think, like how a huge number of African-American women are like suffering
at like higher mortality
rates and childbirth and other diseases, and where that all gets its roots from. It's fascinating. It is unfortunately eye-opening, saying that as a white man. It's a great podcast. It's also just like really well done, like the music and the storytelling in it is great. 1619.
Cool. So I'm going to make a little cat sandwich because...
Hold on.
Because my thing that I consumed was Cats the Movie.
Oh my God.
I went with my dad to Cats on December 26th at 9:15 a.m. Mm. We were the only people in the theater that day. Well, not that day, but that showing.
Maybe that day.
And it was a wild ride. I've seen the musical, or at least the filmed version of the Broadway musical. And I think a lot of the bad reviews for that movie come from the fact that people aren't familiar with how weird Cats the Musical is. And they're expecting it to be better than that. And it's based on the musical, so it's not going to be different. There's really no plot. Why is Rebel Wilson wearing a cat suit on top of her own cat skin? How big are these cats? Why do they have human faces and human hands? why did I have to watch Ian McKellen lap up milk from a saucer?
Sir Ian McKellen.
Sorry, Sir Ian McKellen.
They did you dirty.
It raises a lot of those questions. But it does, I tell you what, it leaves you toe-tapping out of the theater because it has some real bops. So
real bops?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, some real bops.
Cat bops.
Cat bops.
Like memory?
Memory's not a bop, no. Although Jennifer Hudson does a great job. I'm thinking more, yeah, Jellicle Cats is a real banger.
What has
that's
gotten
a thing
into?
That you could say?
Yeah.
I have not seen the musical. Would you say it's, would you say it's very comparable to the musical or very different at all?
I would say it's similar but different. They try to put a plot into the movie that the musical never had.
Right.
Is it a good plot? No, but it is still a plot.
A plot. Gotcha.
I would say it's worth watching when it comes to Netflix or whatever streaming service is going to be on.
Right.
So it's weird, but it's catchy. So there you have it. Cats.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you liked this episode or any of our others, please rate and leave us a quick review. Recently, we have started to see some unique listeners start to pop in. And we know that written reviews and probably 5 stars will also help new listeners decide if they want to give us a listen. So please help us out and some new folks who want to listen to some misconceptions by leaving a quick positive review.
If you want to hear more content like this, you can check out our Sister Wife podcast, From Ew to O, by me.
Don't Pee on Your Leg and Other Scientific Misconceptions is a podcast produced by 2 Birds, 1 Scone. Articles, blog posts, and more about what you can do every day to conserve our environment can be found at www.2birds1scone.org.
Our theme music was an original composition by Camillo.
And if you have any scientific misconceptions that you'd like explained or just want to give us some feedback, please email us at don'tpeeonyourleg@gmail.com. Have a great week!